a miembros de su mesa.
Thank you very much. Our first question will be the presentation by the department. How long do you think you are going to do this presentation? I see it's such a very big document here.
Shepherd, I think we can move through this quickly as you like. The necessary process that you want to ask us some questions subsequent to that. And you also want to make sure we can address it. So we can move through this and we'll listen to it. I suspect
20 to 40 minutes for the type of presentation.
Yeah, I must point out that your report actually, you don't have many issues. Even the Auditor General, actually, there was nothing backed on the department. So I wanted to allay those fears to
you. Are you sure?
I wanted to allay, I'm sure. I want to allay those fears that, no, you don't have to worry that much. But nevertheless, you can present for that 45 minutes the most. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What we've done is, based on our discussion last week, is we've structured some responses to some of the questions that were asked, particularly the questions that were in the document. I see that there's a slightly reformulated document with a shorter set of recommendations. We have responded to the recommendations in both of the documents we had previously. So if you will allow us, we'll go through it briefly and give you a sense of what some of those responses are. Sam, I think if we move to the next slide, which Edwin would address, it deals with the industrial policy issues that were requested in the previous presentation, in the previous discussion. Perhaps, Sam, if we can just go to the content slide. Mm-hmm. Stuck?
Chairperson, we have copies in front of us. Can we ask the department to continue and we just follow it on the copies?
Yeah, I think all of us have got the copies, isn't it? I think we can carry on because we've got the copies before us.
With respect to the contents slide, what we wanted to do is just highlight the role of the SOEs in the RPAP and development state objectives, particularly those of DTR. We wanted to go through some of the funding challenges that were raised, particularly around capitalization and guarantee provision to the SOEs. Question was asked of the Eskom and Transnet investment program. We have provided some of this information before, but we'll give you a bit of an update. The capital structure model, how we deal with transfers, the extent of transfers and guarantees. Shareholder management, questions related to the shareholder management process. Again, we have shared this, but we will reiterate some of that and we'll deal with the specific issues that were raised in the previous meeting. And the further issues that were raised, which is the use of consultants in the department and how that is reflected in the annual report. And then finally, some background on the SIA Airbus contract, which was asked in one of the previous recommendations. And that's the focus of our presentation. So if I can hand over to Edwin to deal with the next area, which is the role of the SOE in RPAP.
Okay, thank you very much. I mean, I think we've shown to you before the slide that in 1976 we were at 16% investment in GDP in infrastructure, of GDP in infrastructure, and this declined by 1994 to around 4%. And then between 1994 and the present, the slide shows the level of investment that we've had in infrastructure in relationship to a benchmark of 10% of GDP, which would be a kind of gut feel target for what kind of rate of investment we should be having. And if based on this relatively crude benchmark, had we been investing between 1994 and 2009 at this rate of 10% of GDP in infrastructure, we would have invested approximately 1.5 trillion rand more in infrastructure than we have been investing. And I think this is an important context to understand the kind of gap that we're facing if infrastructure is to enable economic growth and development. So really what it's saying is that public investments in infrastructure is a key economic enabler. And in order to create a solid foundation for economic growth, you've got to be continuously investing in infrastructure. And a kind of reasonable benchmark, I don't even think it's a particularly aggressive benchmark, is that one would invest at the rate of 10% of GDP in infrastructure, in gross fixed capital. Now, what happened is between 1994 and 2004, we were effectively paying back inherited debt from the apartheid regime. The consequence, though, of paying back that debt is instead of that money being used in infrastructure, there definitely, and this I think is where GEAR is misunderstood. GEAR was fiscal consolidation to create a platform on which we could start investing without having to be repaying debt and the huge interest burden that goes with it. But the resulting gap that we've got is about, had we been investing at this rate of 10%, we would have invested in today's money 1.5 trillion rand more. So when we talk to you about the need for capitalizing SOE, the need for really creating these vehicles that can lead investment in the economy, this is the kind of funding gap we're talking about. But it's indicative. I think the indication is it's a lot. So I think the other insight that we want to take away from the slide which shows the decline in infrastructure spend from 1976 to 1994 is that the supplier industries to the infrastructure cluster declined absolutely in hand. So there's been quite a profound deindustrialization process in terms of our ability to supply components and equipment for infrastructure requirements. I think it's also worth showing you this slide, which is, sorry, the next slide, please. I've got the presentation open on my computer, so I'm kind of pressing the button expecting. I think it's also worth showing to you what happened in this period in the 1970s. In the 1970s, when you were peaking at the 16% of investment, of GDP investment in infrastructure, you had these huge, huge lumpy spends, and this is expenditure on locomotives. And what it does is it shows you that, you know, for a period between 1972 and about 1980, you had between 200, 250 locos procured per annum. And then by and by 1996 you were buying nothing. So it's, if one sees that had you been buying steadily instead of in this lumpy way, at you'd have, over 40 years you'd have been procuring 80 locos a year instead of this huge peak and then this complete decline. And with 80 locos a year, you'd be able to sustain a supplier industry. And it's an important lesson as we move forward not to procure infrastructure in a lumpy way, but in a steady, long-term, programmatic way. Now, if you want to know the substantive role of state-owned enterprises in the industrial policy action plan and in the growth process, I think it's understanding all the multipliers that go through investments in infrastructure. So you have your investment. The impact of the investment is to unlock investment in customer industries. So mines, when they see that Transnet has invested in rail capacity, they invest in new mines. When Eskom invests in new electricities, there's more processing industry, et cetera, et cetera. So it unlocks that investment. It actually, by investing in new, our present locomotive fleet is 32 years old. By investing in new locos, you get improved productivity and service provision within the infrastructure, within Transnet itself, the infrastructure service provider itself. By investing in new locos, it unlocks investments in supply industries, in industries that produce the wheels, the chassis, the bogies, et cetera, for locomotives. So that's another multiplier. A final multiplier is if you invest in rail, for example, you move goods from road onto rail, and you get all kinds of positive externalities, less road congestion, less road damage, lower carbon emissions, and greater safety for all. So you get a whole range of externalities, which also feeds into the economy. The result of all these multipliers is higher GDP, job creation, and associated tax collection, which gives you the money to invest more in infrastructure and keep the thing going. And I think the important thing is that this investment has to be continuous. You have to be thinking of it 20 years. You can't interrupt the cycle and take the surplus that you've created for consumption or for other purposes. Then the cycle stops. And I think that interruption of the process has been a very, very big problem. So if we're to implement this program and an effective infrastructure-driven, let's call it an infrastructure, Honorable McQuinna, how's this for a name? Infrastructure-driven industrialization program. If we're to drive that, there are four key challenges. We've got to raise levels of investment beyond our business as usual over at least the next 15 years. So we're not talking 5 years, at least 15, preferably 30, but at least 15. We have to plan in a way that gets to a steady state of demand. So we're not buying today, and then dropping tomorrow, etc. So it can't be lumpy. We've got to procure in a manner that leverages investments in capability building in the associated supply chain. In other words, we need strategic relationships with suppliers that gives them confidence that we will be buying from them in the long term, not buying from them today and importing from China tomorrow. And finally, we've got to put in place initiatives to optimize the industry response to the investment program. We can't have 10 different companies competing for subscale amount of demand. We will need to consolidate in certain areas. There are four levels of potential fundraising that we need to take into account in our planning. So the first level of investment that we need, and that's predominantly the model that we're on today, is that, and particularly when you look at Transnet, you'll see this is how Transnet are planning. They are planning based on the balance, on their balance sheet capability. They're assuming there's going to be no additional capital, and that's how they are planning. There's a second level of planning required based to deconstrain growth. So in other words, if Transnet or Eskom look at its existing customer requirements and invest to ensure that its existing customers' requirements is fully met. But then there's planning to lead growth, you know, that is to create confidence. Hey, we are creating this additional capacity, so you can put in that mine, you can put in that factory, because there will be energy and logistics capacity to meet it. And this is effectively is a fundamental change in the perception of South Africa as an investment destination from something constructed. You know, the Koreans, when they see us turning away that Alcan investment, they say, listen, you know, that's economic growth. You guys are crazy. The final area is planning to realize the positive externalities that are not related to direct customer demand. Externalities associated with things such as road to rail. I mean, a wonderful example of these externalities is what happened in Soweto, where the municipality invested in tarring the roads, which turned around residents and other people. Instead of having these kind of dusty city, you changed people's perceptions, and you got all kinds of investments and multipliers on the back of tarring the roads. So that's an example of you invest in one place and it has multipliers through those externalities. Now, we need to explore a number of areas of sources of capital to fund this process. So we've got to use retained earnings or profits, and this is what we're doing at the moment. The problem is, if you think in relation to the $1.5 trillion, you know, we ain't going to make enough profits to fund a $1.5 trillion gap. We need to talk about additional equity injections from the fiscus. Now, here, I think that we can be creative in fundraising mechanisms, but the fiscus alone will probably not be sufficient. One of South Africa's powerful comparative advantages is we've got very large mining and industrial companies. Okay, they've got very big balance sheets. We've got to learn to leverage those balance sheets fund the infrastructure program. So, for example, in France, the top 50 energy users in electricity bought 25 years of energy up front, and that capital was used to fund the investment program. So we've got to learn to unlock those balance sheets as well. We've got to enter into compacts with large financial institutions. Hey, we need a certain instrument to invest in infrastructure that wouldn't be the normal level of risk, but is required. Because, hey, the investment in infrastructure creates economic growth, and you benefit from that. And the final area that we can explore is private sector investments as either equity partners or competitors. So we need to do significant additional work in solving this funding problem.
Okay. Will you carry on, Edwin? Who are you? Over there. I see that we've got some visitors.
Chairperson, I've got bodyguards these days. my life is in danger. I have three bodyguards.
Even the state of your
bodyguards?
Yeah, they're my bodyguards. No. They're my nephews, Chair.
Oh, okay. No, they are welcome.
So they could be bodyguards.
Okay.
They fire each other in that organization.
Now, carry on.
Chairperson, where I'll go now is just to give you a highlight of the key issues in respect to the Eskom investment program and what its current status is. So if we can move to the next slide, which demonstrates in map form where some of the major projects are, the mega projects, the $350 billion estimated expenditure over the next 5 years. There are two renewables projects, the SERE, which is 100 megawatts, and it's $1.2 billion. And then there's the CSP in Upington, which is $3.5 billion. Now, those are relatively small in number in terms of investment amounts. The key projects for Eskom are Angula, Madupi, and Kusile. And Kusile is at $170 billion in expenditure, Madupi at $126 billion, and Angula, relatively small, at $22 billion. The important thing from our perspective, having worked in some of the transport area, is that this investment is really substantial. Transnet is planning to spend about $93 billion, and here Eskom is spending $350 billion. If we can just shift to the next slide, Sam. The reason why we require this investment is to ensure that electricity is not a constraint to growth. And what you can see there is peak demand in the orange. And you can see where we've kept pace with that demand 2006 up to 2010. We obviously are all aware of the rolling blackouts that we had of 2-3 years back. The three main power projects are shown there in green, dark and light blue, being Kusile, Angula and Medupi. And that basically keeps us on the trajectory of being able to deliver power supply over that period of time. If we look at access to electricity by province, there's been a huge electrification program that has been, let's say, successful in part. There are two key provinces, and there are poverty-stricken provinces that are still lagging behind, and that's the Eastern Cape and KZN. Part of that is because of the difficulty of accessing some of these rural areas. But rolling out electricity for the national economy to ensure that we're sustainable in terms of manufacturing, mining, et cetera, and to meet these social objectives is obviously key, and that is a key driver for continued investment in Eskom. The next slide, if I can ask Evan to deal with, which deals with the CSDP program in respect of Eskom.
So this slide is really just showing the investment that Eskom has leveraged through procuring in a manner that gets suppliers to compete with one another as not just who's going to supply the good at the lowest cost, but who is going to supply the good and have the biggest impact on our industrial capability. So you can see associated with the Hitachi boiler deal for Medupi and Kusile, there's investments of about 900 million rand in plants as well as training in...
Please switch off our cell phones, please, so that they don't disrupt the system.
You can see that FISA has an investment of 25 million in KwaZulu-Natal associated with and the provision of 275 kilovolt insulators. Actum has made a commitment, and of course, Filsa, who were going to import certain pumps, has, in order to win the contract, has agreed to establish the plant in South Africa at a cost of 60 million rand. So that when I was talking about procuring in such a way that you get your supply chain to invest, as opposed to procure in a way that results in imports and a loss of growth, actually. This is Eskom's progress in that regard.
I'm going to ask Weo to present these slides. Obviously, one of the key challenges, as you're all aware, around Eskom is ensuring that they have enough funding and enough capitalization to proceed with the program of 350 billion. Weo's been intimately involved in this program, and she'll take you through some of the challenges and some of the solutions around the funding requirement for Eskom.
Thank you, Andrew. Basically, the slide that's being displayed up there at the moment displays the funding shortfall that Eskom has for the 7-year period up until the commissioning of the Kusile Power Station. So currently, the build program is estimated to be 693 billion rand, and the funding shortfall to complete the build is 189 billion. The build is currently being financed through the revenue, which is derived from the tariffs as well as equity and debt. And currently, the Eskom doesn't have enough reserves to fund the shortfall. So as government, we've been looking at a solution to try and plug the gap. At the moment, we are looking at extending the current guarantee framework from 176 billion to 350. And as DPE, we've also applied for an additional 20 billion rand in equity through the MTF process. I'd like the committee to note that none of the above mentioned has been approved by the National Treasury and as yet, and we are waiting feedback on that. Next slide was basically explaining
without jumping the gun, the 20 billion.
Yes.
It is obviously throwing the responsibility on us.
As government.
As far as the BRRR is concerned.
The 20 billion basically it's to assist with the balance sheet structuring of Eskom. So as to allow Eskom to get additional debt from the market. Without it, I mean, we are currently rated as sub-investment grade, and without that 20 billion, we won't be able to access the additional funding that we want to get in the market, which will then make the 174 billion in guarantees that we're applying for basically useless, because Eskom won't be able to get the money.
Yes, now I understand that. Chairperson, through you, the significance of my question lies in the because we are now conducting this this budget review, exercise. It means then, out of our recommendations, we'll have to include that request of 20 billion. That's the essence of my question. So that we don't just take it for granted that you to be taken care of in subsequent years. It's a kind of a fulcrum of your presentation as far as financial needs are concerned. Yeah. Am I right?
I think the reality is that on the basis of the estimates that we've done for Eskom and the need to ensure that we are sustainable in terms of provision of power is we do require some equity for the reasons that Fuyo has indicated. Part of the reality is that if you don't have equity and you're funding it all from debt, the rates that you will get are going to be very low. But by the same token, Treasury has a real severe budget constraint at the moment. It doesn't have 20 billion. So we are currently in the process, and I think Fuyo has made it very clear, that this is not agreed upon position. What we're sharing with you is the position that we are negotiating with Treasury. And so at a particular point, they will have to make a call, and we will probably have to go to Cabinet with that recommendation.
In other words, Parliament actually has to include this on the recommendations, you say.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. On this bill.
Yes,
on this current financial
year. I think that's what Honourable Member Mukwena wanted to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Because the 20 billion that is needed is the fulcrum of this presentation in so far as our budget review what mechanism is concerned. That would take care of what you're saying, Dr. Shaw, that when you go to Treasury, you go with a recommendation derived from parliamentary exercises that have seen reason for you to require this amount of money.
I think that would make sense. Our challenge, of course, is that we also have to work with Treasury to understand their own constraints. And so we don't want to be seen into pushing a position which in overall national terms is unaffordable. But we have been through most of those discussions already. And so we are in a position now where I think we're fairly clear that the 20 billion is the minimum equity requirement in order to sustain the investment program. If she can get it for us. Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that it wouldn't be rational to fund this purely from equity either. You know, to go and seek 190 in equity would not be a rational investment decision. So there's somewhere between the amounts of zero and 190, you would want to seek some breakdown of equity versus debt. And at the moment, what we're looking for is much lower amounts of equity. But the reason that we're doing that is because there's affordability constraints within government. I think if we wanted to ideally fund Eskom to undertake this investment, we would probably want much greater levels of equity investment than we've requested, but we've tried to be as realistic as we can.
So in other words, it means that that shortfall of around 190 billion has to be forked out by the consumer, which means the tariffs have to be raised again after the 31%. Does that mean that?
Yeah. No such thing as a free lunch, you know. That's what they say. And the reality is we've got to pay for these power stations. And
okay, let me give the Honourable Kreding an opportunity.
Point of order, Chairperson, can you allow the presentation to finish?
I thought maybe it was a third question of...
No, he's going to delve into questioning.
Yeah. Okay.
Mark it, Chief.
You can carry on.
Okay, if I can move to the Transnet Investment Program. Sam, I don't know where. There we go. The Transnet Investment Program is a much lower amount. It's 93 billion. Historically, we've spent 72 billion on infrastructure. There's been massive infrastructure investments, as you've probably seen in the ports and on the rail system. There's a few important things about this 93 that is important to understand. It's first of all the projection, and they've made this projection public, is that it's due to decline. Now, the reality in our discussion with Transnet is that it's unlikely to decline in the way that it is. As each five-year corporate plan is revisited, we will see a revisit of the capital investment program. So what you see there is really the impact of the mega projects on the capital program. So we expect the capital program over the next 5 years to increase above that 93 billion. The other important thing is in the bottom left-hand part of the slide is you'll see the projected expenditure on replacement versus on expansion. And the important thing to understand here is that replacement makes up nearly 80% of investment, particularly going on into the latter years. And what this is actually to take existing infrastructure and rehabilitate that infrastructure. And it's part of the challenge that Edwin raised earlier, which is that we have failed to invest in infrastructure and we are still in catch-up mode. And this really reflects that the last 5 years capital investment program was mostly around rehabilitation, and that continues to be the case. So we are still continuing to catch up in this space, and very little of the available investment towards 2014-15 is actually on expansion. And we need capital expansion in order for the economy to grow, and that's a critical point that we need to focus on. If we look at the main projects that we have in Transnet, I won't go through these in a lot of detail. There's a lot of focus on the terminal investment in Richards Bay, particularly to support coal expansion of the Coal Link line, as well as the dry bulk terminal refurbishment in Richards Bay. The focus is to keep Richards Bay a port that is predominantly focused on bulk products. In Durban, there's a lot of re-engineering of container terminal. Harbour entrance widening continues to be a large project. The berth deepening in order to be able to address the needs of larger vessels, and reconstruction of Maiden Wharf. Cooker is a terminal that still requires additional investment. We need also to bring a terminal operator into that terminal. Cape Town, reconfiguration of Cape Town container terminal. And then Sishen-Saldanha, there's a major expansion drive there to increase the iron ore line, and 4.9 billion is projected to be expended on that corridor. If we move to the next slide. This is really the same projects in tabular form. I think the important thing to point out here is that the funding source on the second last column from the right demonstrates the extent to which this is funded by debt and retained earnings. The important issue here is that Transnet is not projected to come to government for guarantee support, which we're able to breathe a sigh of relief really around this because of the requirements of Eskom. This means that we have one of our second largest SOEs not requiring huge guarantee support from Treasury. However, one of the challenges of this is whether we're able to keep up with our investment requirements in logistics and transport without any debt requirements. So the basis for the Transnet corporate plan and the projects that I've demonstrated here is that they would be funded on the back of earnings. And the question should still be asked whether we will have sufficient infrastructure under those conditions. Do you want to talk to this briefly, Ed?
So this is really just showing you the Transnet supplier development program, particularly relating to locomotives. And what you can see is that with each deal, the complexity of the supplier development process is growing. So in this latest GE deal, there is a great deal of emphasis on making investments to get the South African production processes up to global standards. So GE did an assessment, and basically if GE finds a very, very promising supplier for their global supply chain, it takes them 2 years to get that supplier up to GE standards, meaning that their quality controls are in place, their inventories are very tightly controlled, their production processes are very lean. The point being that until you get a certification from an organization like GE as being compliant to their standards, from a global supply chain point of view, you don't exist. You're not going to be taken into account. So what the latest 100 locomotive deal is doing is the GE people say your plant is okay, your hardware is okay, but your production processes, your production skills, your quality controls, et cetera, are based on kind of 60s thinking. And so what they're doing through many hundreds of millions rand investments is fundamentally upgrading the way the whole production process takes place to get it to globally competitive standards. The next step is a fleet procurement where we want to buy, instead of buying 100 locos and then going out to tender again, to see if we can't buy, let's say, 120 locos a year, 60 diesel, 60 electric, over a 15-year period. At the moment, the amount of local content in these locomotives is in the region of 33%. What GE think is over an 8-year period, that 33% can be increased to about 66%, but it's going to take 8 years of systematically building capability, firming it up, and then adding additional capability. So that's the process in supplier development.
Anthony, can I ask you to deal with capital structure?
The department set out to create and utilize a consistent capital structure decision-making framework. And this was basically developed to incorporate the risks underlying each SOE, primarily to incorporate and quantify the impact on the financials due to changes in core projects, changes in operational levers, as well as macroeconomic variables. And basically it was to provide a means of quantifying and optimizing the capital allocation strategies in the SOE. Primary objective of the framework was to assess and indicate with a particular level of certainty the amount of capital that would be required given the investment horizon and projected capital infrastructure requirements. But importantly, and I think this ties into what was being said around the ESCOM, it was getting to a point where you did it to maximize the value of the SOE by optimally allocating that capital requirement between equity and debt. We have developed this framework, but we made a lot of progress in that. And then we then discovered that National Treasury had also embarked on a similar model, developing a similar model. So we have now started working with National Treasury. our shareholder assessing the capital requirements, and if we can come up with a model that is applicable to all SOEs, not just the ones that that are within the DPE, I think it would work out better, because then there will be a common understanding across across the SOE and National Treasury in terms of the capital allocations. So that's what we're working towards, getting that synergy between those two. Just moving on to the transfers to the SOEs over the last few years, you will see that there has been a market decrease in transfers to the SOEs, and in 2011-12, there are no transfers earmarked. If we just look at some of the totals there, we see that the biggest recipient of transfers over the period 2004-05 was PBMR, to which 8.3 billion was allocated, but we see all the transfers dropping off to an amount of zero in 2011-12. However, conversely, on the side of the contingent liabilities, in terms of government guarantees, we had seen a drop off over the last few years, but given the guarantee support that is now going to ESCOM, that has risen quite sharply, and we see that in 2010-11 already there's that 176 billion in guarantee exposure. That's the continued exposure of government in terms of the guaranteed debt.
Thank you. This slide essentially just sets up the governance structure of our state-owned enterprises, and is part of the attempt to just clarify the roles and responsibilities of the different stakeholders within the governance structure. As you can see from the top, the presidency has responsibility to oversee the performance of all ministers, which would include our minister. And then on the other side is Parliament, which obviously also oversees our minister as the executive authority of the state-owned enterprises, and the focus there would be on the transparency and accountability of the minister and the department as part of the minister's technical support. The minister is the shareholder representative for government, and in terms of the PFMA is the executive authority. In terms of a shareholder management model, the powers and responsibilities of the minister vis-a-vis the board and management are then set out in that model, just to provide clarity for all parties concerned. And the shareholder management model is derived from the Companies Act, which regulates the governance for all companies, which would obviously then include our SOEs, which are incorporated and registered as companies and are regulated by the Companies Act. And also, as part of public sector management, the PFMA also sets out the rules and responsibilities of shareholders and SOE, and is what we base the shareholder management model on as well. And the shareholder primarily is responsible for the appointment of the board and the removal of directors from the board. And the board includes the executive directors, currently being the CEO and the CFO, and these are appointed by virtue of their offices. And the second responsibility of the shareholder is approving the remuneration of all directors, which again includes the executive directors. With respect to the board, the roles and responsibilities of the board are to be the custodian of the company. This is based on company law, as well, and is also set out in the PFMA. And the board is the conduit through which the shareholder would then oversee the activities of management. and the board is required to act in the best interest of the SOE as well as the shareholder. With respect to... No. Go back. Okay. And then on management, the role and responsibility of management is really to oversee the daily operations of the company and to report to the board. This, again, is based on company law as well as the PFMA. And for most SOE, the roles and responsibilities of the management and the board would also be set out in the articles of association. And executive management is represented by the CEO and the CFO and accounts to the board. And the board, in turn, would then account to the shareholder. And lastly, the executive management is appointed by the board, and the employment relationship is between the SOE and the management, and the SOE in this regard would be represented by the board.
The department has previously shared what we developed, the logical planning, monitoring, and evaluation process with the committee. This is basically an annual chronological cycle of tasks and events that seeks to link national strategic priorities to SOE delivery. And it also seeks to ensure effective shareholder oversight and achievement of desired objectives by the SOE. It all starts with the strategic intent statement, which is a primary tool to communicate the state's expectations of SOE strategy. And in developing that strategic intent statement, to ensure clarity and transparency of those objectives for the SOE, and also to clarify all the trade-offs between policy, regulatory, and customer interests, as well as the SOE's financial interests. The department consults with the sector departments, National Treasury, as well as the presidency in developing the strategic intent statement. And then this is then communicated to the SOE by minister. Then following that, the minister and the SOE board conclude a shareholder compact annually. And this basically sets out all the KPAs and KPIs that must be attained by the SOE in delivering the desired outcomes and objectives. On the back of that, then the SOE is expected to develop and submit a corporate plan to the department, outlining the implementation details for achieving the agreed objectives, and this is done a month before the commencement of the financial year. One of the key areas that we work in is the continuous review of the SOE performance, and this we have been doing and have developed the ISIBUCO dashboard, which seeks to make SOE reporting on a timely and consistent basis in all the areas of SOE delivery. The department monitors the SOE performance on a quarterly basis and then on an annually basis. And basically, the assessment is to monitor whether SOE performance is in line, the trends and the performance are in line with set out targets and objectives, and then also to then communicate to the SOE where it is observed that the SOE performance trends are deviating from the agreed KPIs. And in this regard, Minister issues an investor brief on a quarterly basis, highlighting any areas areas of emerging risk, and asking the SOE board to take corrective measures on those areas. So we framework is something that has come up in the last year, and we have increasingly been we have been managing ourselves according to it, and the members will see from this table that all the SOE are compliant with this process, except basically for PBMR, which is due to the current circumstances. Some of the areas, such as the strategic intent and shareholder compact, have not been put in place. However, even in the process that PBMR is going through, the department is actually actively involved in the monitoring of that process to ensure that an optimal resolution of that process is achieved. Looking at the risk management framework, the DPE framework basically follows those main steps, starting with objective setting, and that derives from the strategic intent and the mandate for each of those SOE, and then trying to identify what can go wrong to or what can be prevent those objectives being achieved, and what would be the causes of such risk. Then it would be a case of assessing the chances of that particular risk occurring, and that would be the likelihood and what effect that it would have if it were to occur, and that would be the impact. And then developing an appropriate risk response and control activities. And in this regard, it would actually allocate responsibilities. It's not just a case of identifying what needs to be done. Those tasks are actually allocated and time frames for taking particular actions set out. So this is basically an ongoing process, and if you could move to the next slide, this will be the view of the risk dashboard that we have in the ISOBUCO dashboard, which is where the risk the top one there basically the top right basically shows the inherent risk, and that will be the risk risk profile before taking any remedial action. And then the bottom one, the residual risk, would be the risk profile with the control measures in place. That would be the plot of the impact versus the likelihood of the particular risk. Then this one basically shows the trend in each of the risks, as well as the average risk exposure. If we were live on the dashboard, we could actually click on each of those risks and just see what the trend is on a quarterly basis. And if we see that the trend is actually going up, then that's a cause for worry. Then you're quickly alerted to the fact that probably the control measures that are in place are not effective, and you really need to come up with new control measures.
Jay, I'm aware that we probably moved a little bit beyond our time frame, so let me deal with these last few slides very quickly. The last few deal with reporting in respect of consultants, where I think the committee just wanted some clarity from us. What we have here is the public service regulations, which indicate the definition of a consultant, which means a natural or juristic person or partnership, which provides in terms of specific contracts and ad hoc service. We've based our annual report on this definition as is consistent with what is required by the auditors. If we move to the next slide, Sam. This is our expenditure. Business and advisory services is 40 million, legal costs 5.1, contractors is 1.5, and agency support outsourced services 3.7. If we move to the next slide, Sam, what is key, I think what we'd like to conclude is that our expenditure on consultants has in fact declined. It's declined from 56 million in 2008-09 to 51 million now, whilst the rest of our budget has had inflationary increases. So effectively, our use of consultants has dropped quite significantly. Business and advisory services is an area where we've decreased, and legal costs we've incurred some increases, partly because some of the challenges that we've faced in respect of contractual obligations with the SOEs, issues around PBMR, and we've required some legal input there. I think if there's any questions in this regard, Ursula will be able to give you some sense of why this budget has increased over that period of time. And the contractors and agency support have really remained relatively static over this period. So in the next slide. Now, the final area that I would like to deal with, and I can do this very quickly, is the A320 transaction by Airbus, which was raised as one of the bullets in the previous reports. I think the issue here is that this transaction was signed by the management and board of SAA in 2002, at a time when the PFMA was not a requirement. So a Section 54 obligation was not required at that particular point in time, and it led to the situation where the board approved the purchase of 41 aircraft in three tranches, and that this was a contract that was very difficult for SAA to get out of without some considerable cost. In 2004, the SAA board attempted to cancel the A320 purchase agreement, but was not able to do so. So we essentially inherited a challenge where the shareholder had to become quite intimately involved. And if you go to the next slide, Sam, what this demonstrates is what we were able to negotiate at that point around improving the third tranche of that transaction. So there were three tranches to the original Airbus transaction in 2002. What we were able to do is renegotiate the third tranche, and that was the purchase of A320 aircraft. The original purchase requirement in the third tranche was for 15 aircraft. What we were able to do with Airbus is keep that envelope in monetary terms the same, but we were able to get 20 aircraft for the same price at existing market conditions. What is important to realize also is that these A320 aircraft are mid-range aircraft that can be used in the domestic and in the African market. And that's the area where SAA, the domestic market, is where SAA is break-even to slightly positive in operating profit terms. African market is where SAA is really quite profitable, and it's quite often that market that is used to cross-subsidize the intercontinental market. So we were comfortable as shareholders that the aircraft that we were looking for was aircraft that could be used in markets that were already making solid returns, and that over time, although the lease costs or the purchase prices would have been greater, the operational efficiency that would be delivered by these aircraft would be in SAA's benefit. So the end-term analysis is that we got the aircraft at market value. We didn't overpay for them, as we were going to do under the original contract, and we were putting them into the market in places where they could best be utilized. The challenge for SAA is to make sure that they have sufficient funding to support the pre-delivery payments for these aircraft, and that's the point that I think we need to sustain, both as shareholder and as Parliament, we need to sustain the pressure on SAA, on SAA, so that they don't come back to government seeking financial support for taking these aircraft on. But it's very clear to us that if we had to have cancelled this contract, it would have resulted in extreme cost to SAA for aircraft that we probably would have required in any case. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Andrew, with the team. I would want now to, you are very, very to the point, actually. You didn't take much time on the presentation. I want to open up for discussions, questions, comments, and all that. I'll start with Honorable Bowman, Honorable Mkwena, Honorable Hailing, and then Van Dalen, and Gordon North. And the last will be Honorable Santo, in that order. Thank you.
you. I want to thank you. I think one can never have enough information at one's disposal, and especially when we come in as new members here. So, you know, we appreciate you going through this and the input that you've made. Obviously, the bottom line is just sort of finance, finance, finance. Can I just ask you in relation to this last thing about the Airbus? And I mean, we had SAA here yesterday, and I appreciate the comment that we need to keep the pressure on. And that, and I must say, I'm very impressed with the new CEO. So, you know, and I think that's very positive. But the finance, the capital required, you know, is it realistic? Considering the huge sums of money, and I know, you know, now we're beginning to turn it around, and they're looking at, you know, through the restructuring of where they can cut and all this kind of thing. Is the department confident that, you know, putting the pressure on, we actually can do that? And then I don't have any other questions, except to say that I think, I don't know whether it would be possible. I would like to sort of go and see this risk thing that you've got where we can click on and you're able to, you know, at the press of a button. I don't know whether that's possible, but I think it would be very, very good to go and see how that works.
Thank you, Honourable Bowman. I wanted to suggest something, actually. While we are going to be asking questions and comments, if we could also come up with recommendations, because we've got this other document here where we have to also come up with recommendations. Mm-hmm. While we ask those questions, bear in mind that we could also come up with recommendations. Honorable Mbwena.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. I think you have taken the wind out of my sails on the question of recommendations. Right. One question which should not kill the major one that's supposed to, just a clarification. Does the department, DB, do you have a board? No, I know the SOEs do have their own boards. Do you have a super DB board? Then I can go from there. Yes or no?
Okay, no, you cannot respond now. I want to.
Now, I've got three questions, but that's a major one. Yeah, just to clarify.
We operate as a government department, and so we don't have any kind of board structure. Our responsibilities are exactly the same. The DG is the accounting officer, and the minister is an appointed politician who operates a separate ministry. We support the minister as the shareholder, and she is, in fact, the government representative. In a certain sense, we are like advisors to the shareholder.
You're fine. It was a kind of a rhetorical question because I wanted to clear the organogram. Now, part of the recommendation, Chairperson, would be that, and it's linked to the fact that there's a gap here. Well, there's actually a duplication. The mandate of DBE is that they must oversee all the SOEs. Now, we as a patrol committee are also conducting oversight. So there's a duplication, there's a double oversight here. Right. So DBE is kind of shortchanged because it's not rigorously doing managerial work. All they're doing now is like an eagle just to make sure that the wheels don't actually come off. So if they had a bolder mandate to actually manage, then we wouldn't, perhaps a lot of damage should have been minimized, especially in the era of the management style of the former CEO of the SAA. They would have been able to crack the whip. They were not able to do so, according to order, because they are doing the oversight, and he probably said, hey, don't tell me what to do, you're doing the oversight, so they cannot back on. So that delinquency would not have occurred, number one. Number two, the PBMR debacle would also have been, would not have occurred. Therefore, what are we saying? We are saying a major recommendation by this portfolio committee should be that across the board, all these departments, there should be boards of management There should be boards. Because what the organogram we're going to do with the minister, with the DG, then you've got the, you know, the functionaries, you know, CFOs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you see, it's a bit loose there. Whereas if you had a heavyweight board, I know it's have some overhead, but you see, it weight in terms of governance, corporate governance. So I feel very strongly about that, that you should actually have a heavyweight state so that you don't have looseness that is there, but the looseness also makes the governance very vulnerable, because you have then what the chairperson, Comrade Frankie Mingus, worried about the turnover of COs. They move from one department to the other, etc., etc., and other people also do that. And with all these acting CEOs, acting, precisely because you don't have a heavy management structure at the board level. You see, the minister is there, and as a political head, then with the DG, and then with all the other. But you see, it's loose there. You see, that's why I see the paucity. There's a lack there of governance. So you need to install those governmental sinews to strengthen the department at that level. Then when you go down to the SOEs, you don't have to have heavy boards there, because the top is already strong. So that's recommendation number one. I could be wrong, but I feel very strongly about it.
If I may come in, I don't know if it would be necessary to have a recommendation like that, because here we have to come up with recommendations for the financials, for the MTEF.
I understand that. You see, this is a novel. This is a first of its kind. I don't think we should restrict ourselves, because the Parliament has given an opportunity to come with recommendations. Because you see, the organogram, to a very large extent, also affects the money. Like I was saying, we lost a lot of money because the organogram was weak. So we cannot say, let's only concern the money and forget about the structure, when in fact the structure itself would actually influence to the extent to what which you actually lose or make money. I'm not saying many heads will make money, but I'm just saying, you know, when there are more brains, then of course the governance could be improved. I don't think we should really be shy on that one, because if we do that, then it means it's going back to square one. There's no need why I should have the B triple R. We can just carry on like before. So we have a novel opportunity to actually install sinews and recommendations. So that's recommendation number one. Number two, just a little question. Kubek, not Kubek, Muha. I think I know it falls under DTI, but to what extent is there a role for, let me not answer my question now. Under what ages does Kubek technically fall? Does it fall under several jurisdictions, authority, DTI, DPE, etc., etc.? And whose baby is actually is Muha or not? So I'm saying Muha. And linked to that chairperson is, does Muha have an anchor tenant now? Because for a long time, you know, there was the struggle to get an anchor tenant. Right. What is the last one now? The last one, I've forgotten the last one. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Chair. I have a couple of points. I'm just trying to put this all together. Okay, let me start with, I think your capital structural model is a good suggestion. I mean, I've always been amazed that there's some state-owned enterprises that fall under public enterprises and there's some that don't, and I've never quite understood the rationale for that. And it seems that the ones that don't fall under you also get given a kind of free hand to invest as they choose. And one example is PetroSA, which I just found out this week has spent 2 billion rand exploring for oil and gas and not coming up with anything in Equatorial Guinea and Egypt. I mean, as to how that decision was made, I fail to know. And the same would apply to the state-owned mining company as well. I mean, my understanding is that any kind of parastatal that is owned by South Africa should have some kind of strategic objective in terms of how that money is spent, in terms of reaching our kind of developmental state objectives. And often I don't see that as being the case in other departments, and I think that it's something that needs to be addressed. As far as Eskom is concerned, which obviously is the nub of this presentation, I think, and I think it's the key thing which we need to grapple with here. Now, I want to bring up a couple of points around this. I mean, you mentioned the electrification program to say how successful we've been at that. We were successful. We were very successful up until 2000 where we connected a number of households through that program. What I've seen since then, though, is that that has been taken away from ESCOM to a large extent and put in the hands of the Department of Energy, and that process has kind of ground to a halt. Yes, in urban areas we've managed to do some electrification, but clearly in rural areas that process is not going ahead at all. And so it's a bit disingenuous to kind of laud the achievements of the electrification program when I'm not seeing major achievements going forward now, nor am I seeing any plan coming forward from the Department of Energy or from ESCOM as to how they're really going to get to those deep rural areas. There's nothing. Those guys have been cut off, and there doesn't seem to be a plan for that. And I think that this could be a huge opportunity to really put in place a renewable energy plan that could actually then spur the market on and get electricity to many rural areas which have been excluded. So I think that's the first point to be raised. And I raise that point as well because when I look at the new build program, I still constantly ask, who are we building this electricity for? But constantly we get told that it's to keep the lights on. Well, it's not really to keep these lights on. It's actually to keep the industries, heavy industries, going and allowing them to expand. And when I, for instance, look at the IRP that's just come out, and I look at the demand forecast, which is the nub of it, the majority of the demand forecast is around the expansion of mining and industry. That is the majority of the new build program is going to be meeting that. And when we look at the industrial component, it's around smelters, ferrochrome smelters, aluminium smelters. It's around these big investments. So let's be honest about it. This new build program is not about getting electricity out to those that don't have electricity. It's not about keeping the lights on of normal households. It's actually about allowing for a major expansion of essentially heavy industries and energy-intensive industries. I mean, that's the truth of it. Now, what you're saying in this model is that government needs to give 20 billion rand in equity, plus they need to give a guarantee of 350 billion rand. Now, essentially, so South Africa, all of us, are having to take the risk for a major expansion of electricity, whereas it's the heavy industries and a couple of companies that are going to get the rewards of this, and they don't take the risk for this. Now, clearly, this is not a financing model that we should be looking at. I mean, I actually think that those heavy industries should be taking far more of a risk of this. At the very least, we need take-off agreements to say that these expansion plans are written in stone, that they will definitely take that electricity. And secondly, they should be providing some of the equity to allow us to build this. This is what we should be looking at if that is our plan going forward. Also what we need to do, I mean, you mentioned that South Korea said that they can't believe we turned the Elkan smelter away. Well, the problem that we've had in South Africa is that we love to go and build these big smelters, but we've got no downstream agreements with them. So all of this aluminium is smelted here at a heavy cost to the environment and to our electricity usage, and then sent across to Australia to be the value added there. You know, and we've been terrible at actually ensuring that we get some benefits from these particular things. ArcelorMittal is a case in point. They weren't selling the steel at cheaper prices to South Africa. So all of these things need to be looked at before we give a guarantee that, yes, South Africa should go and take the risk on huge amounts of money, which will put us in jeopardy on a whole range of issues. And we need to know that there's going to be industrial development benefits coming out of that. And I'm not seeing that at the moment. I'm still waiting for the new growth path from Minister Ibrahim Patel. I'm still waiting to see these documents before we go and give approval for such a massive expansion, such a massive risk undertaking. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Khwaelin. Honourable Sandale.
Yes, luckily Honourable Khwaelin spoke about me, so I have two questions less. I just wanted to, it was one of interest is that does the PFMA allow public enterprises to have top management that are contractors, say the CFO or the top management of a company to be contractors or to be advisors. I mean, especially if the CFO of a company is a contractor, I mean, who signs off on all the receipts and all the okays, everything? And then if they're a contractor, they obviously get paid hourly, so this is quite expensive. And this is happening at AlexCor, I believe, where the CEO is a contractor. And then some other members of the top management. I can tell you I was there, and I got the feeling that this is a company in limbo. They don't know what to do because they don't have direction. You know, the onerous contracts and the legacy issues, contracts that have been signed for 25 years where Eskom gives power to BHP Billiton for an extended period, and it's below the cost of generation. What is the DPE's part in ensuring that those contracts or assisting those companies to get rid of those contracts? I mean, this company or this country, when it had excess, I mean, nobody would say anything about it, but the problem is that, you know, we are all tightening the belt, and we are all in the same boat, and we have to cut back. So why should these companies, just because they have a contract for 25 years, pick the benefits of it and not pay for it? I mean, the vice president of BHP Billiton came down to see me, so I told him, you know, if I had a company like yours, I would make sure that electricity supply was the one thing that I have. Why don't you give Eskom the 200 billion rand? So he just said, well, we are not in electricity generation, but they want to buy potash and crab farms and everything else, but generate electricity. So, you know, I think they should come to the table. They have had the benefit of these cheap electricity for a long time. They've made a lot of money, and I think we should pressure them to pay the shortfalls that exist in any way. Then there was the issue where I asked last time at East London. I see you don't have any upgrades for Transnet at East London, and there it specifically went around the grain silos that are now shut down because of safety issues, and which is going to have a huge impact on the grain export through that harbour, which is also, I mean, East London is not one of your most affluent areas, so they need the bedrijvigheden, industry in that area, same as Kuga and all the others in the eastern side of our country. So I just wanted to hear your take on that. That is my contribution. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Van Dalen.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to on the Airbus 320, I agree with what the CEO of SAA said yesterday to this committee. It's purely a face-saving exercise. SAA made a huge mistake in 2002 make a decision to buy 41 aircraft was not affordable at that time, and within 2 years they cancelled the contract. And what we have now is a renegotiation amendment of the contract. So my view is it is purely a face-saving exercise, like with the CEO, but that's water under the bridge. Can I ask your budget for the year under review and the rollout of the department is decreasing dramatically from billions to millions? And surely the question that other members has asked, where certain SOEs report to the department, others are outside the ambit of the department, surely we have to look at a rethink of the role of the department with a decreased budget and the important mandate that you have of overseeing state-owned entities, and whether the nine you have at the moment is sufficient, or whether they others should also report to you or taken away to other mother departments. I just want to a future glance from your side as an acting DG going into the future, next couple of years. I've asked in a previous committee, this committee is now going to make recommendations. Can I be, if you don't rule me out of order, Chairperson, if we were to ask you as a committee, which recommendations would you prefer to see this committee making to Parliament regarding the budget review report recommendations.
Governor of Coronel, I think we'll need to offer them the opportunity to give us their own recommendations. But we've got also our own recommendations as a committee as well. Honorable Sonto.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think this this exercise, Chairperson, seeks to address the reality that government has to defend its policy decisions or its administrative decisions. And the strategic intent of us having state-owned enterprises was to make them achieve our objectives as government. Now, the first question would be in line with what Dr. Koronoff has said. Which entities do you think are useless? I want to be as blunt as that. Because in one area, I don't think I understood it quite clearly. When UCC was giving us all these, what are these now, SOEs, but they are compliant with logical planning, monitoring, and evaluation process. All of them got no mistake except for PBMR. But the question begs, let's go to Alexco and get stationed there. What is the role of Alexco if a state-owned enterprise is supposed to be one, to be self-sustaining in its operations, and also deliver to the social and labor plans? Critical to that, we've been told, I think Honorable Member Mokwena hinted on this. Alexco is involved in a town development program or project. We've been told until we found out that or we've been made to believe that they are engaging in that exercise using the profits they make in their operations in the area, only to discover later that they are just managing. You give them money as a department. That project or program is a DPE program, not an Alexco one. What is Alexco doing, therefore? What are they doing there? Are they buying two ostriches and give them to communities and say that they are plowing back to the communities? Now, these are the kinds of questions that we would want to address. I think Honorable Member Van Dalen said it's an SOE in limbo. Now, would we say, as government and yourselves, as a shareholder, would you regard Alexco, in particular, as a success case? We need these SOEs, but these SOEs should address the requirements for which they were established. I don't want to get to others. I want to get stationed on this one with a precursor that's
says, do you have any other SOEs that you need to get rid of, Dr. Shaw? So really, I would want to be appraised on Alexco. I really don't know. The CEO is managing it from Johannesburg.
Can you believe it?
She is managing it from Johannesburg. Whenever she goes to meetings, she flies over. Diamond extraction from the sea is processed in the sea, and a helicopter goes over our poor people, take that wealth, fly over our poor people, and they would just look at the wealth that is going over their heads to either Pietermaritzburg or to wherever. That community there is living under abject poverty. Is that what we would want to see these SOEs doing to our objectives as government? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sondra. That's a scandal, I must say. Scandal. There's no other way. There's no other word for it. Let me also pose a question as well with regard to Transnet. I can realize that Edwin is gone already, but maybe we'll be in a position to answer to this one. On the procurement of 100 locomotives, replacing the old fleet, so I understand. In that, what is it that we're going to do with the old fleet of locals there? And then on that procurement, actually, I wonder if we, as a committee, we should also include it in our recommendation that you intend purchasing these 100 locomotives on our recommendations. And then on the consultants, I would like to know as to whether those consultants, are they not the ones that were previously working for the SOEs, most of them, and then they come on the front and then pose themselves as consultants. And then on the aircraft, I would like to know whether you are leasing these aircraft or you are buying them. That would be my questions. Thank you very much. And then, Honorable Sonda, I see that you want to make a follow-up.
Just one little one, Chairperson, that I wanted clarity on. That is slide 31, which is strictly confidential. All of them are strictly confidential. The shareholder, I just want to understand this thing. Responsible for the appointment and removal of directors from the board, which includes the appointment of executive directors, which is CEO and CFO. And then on the management, the executive management, represented by the two, is accountable to the board, and the board is accountable to the shareholder. Thus, the board would manage the performance. One key fear that I have there, which I need to be appraised on, who appoints the CEO? Because if we miss it there, hell will break loose in the entire establishment. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Santo. And respond to those, Andrew.
Okay, thank you very much, Chair and the committee. If I can run through them and try and combine some of them where there's some similarity, and then ask some of the team to fill in as necessary, if you're comfortable with that. I think the Honourable Borman asked questions around SIA, which then some additional committee members asked. maybe if I can just respond to that one first. I think the issue in respect of the Airbus transaction is that we got ourselves into a very intractable position where we would have defaulted with a major player and with another government, and that if we were a private airline, we may have selected to do something different, and that's perhaps some of the issue around the face-saving approach. However, it does bother me that that is what the CEO has necessarily come to the committee with, because I think I wouldn't like the situation where SAA, the executive and the board, use it as an excuse for why they may not be able to afford this transaction going forward. The reality is that they require these aircraft, and if they didn't get them through this transaction, they would have to enter some other kind of transaction to get these aircraft, perhaps not in the profile over the time frame, but they require this kind of short-range single-aisle aircraft in any case, especially in those markets where they're expanding. So, you know, while I agree with the point, I do have some hesitation in fully supporting the initiative that it was just for face-saving. I think that's an unfortunate excuse that can be used to rationalize why they may not at some point be able to afford these. The issue about ensuring that you sustain the pressure on them is something that we feel very strongly about. We are still concerned. We get SAA financials on a monthly basis. We are still concerned about the quality.
You know, there's a contradiction in what you are saying, with your respect, because, you see, SAA took a decision to cancel the order. They took a conscious decision to say we are canceling the order, but for some recorded strange reason, the supplier misunderstood that the order has been canceled, and that is why then there was a revisit by SAA to actually say, hey guys, we're actually talking to you. Oh, if you are, this is a story. So I think let's be honest here, because I mean there's no need pulling wool. So I mean the CEO yesterday was very very forthright, because we just tried. We're not grilling, but we just will congregate. This is the message you had, even on the radio. You know, members were quoted as complimenting SAA for doing what we, because as MPs, we just don't want to grill. We're not police people here. Because we are public representatives. Where there's good, we congratulate. But where things will come off, that's exactly our job. Because, you see, if we don't do that, and some of us are very sorry, because PBMR would not have happened. We've lost close to 9 billion precisely because we didn't address the truth. So we must be very forthright. And if there's a bad deal, there's a bad deal, it's fine. We're just making a few little adjustments in the bureaucracy, but actually just to avoid being sued and losing all the money. But I think the blatant truth is that now it does face everything to avoid a loss. I don't think we should say that's an excuse. It is. We should not brush that aside with due respect.
I think we must realize that there was no way for SAA to cancel this transaction.
Mm-hmm.
We sought legal opinion at the time. We sought legal opinion overseas. We also went to identify where other airlines had renegated on a transaction with Airbus. And so one must realize that although SAA tried to cancel it, they had no legal right to cancel this contract.
Let us just be appraised on that one, acting teaching. SAA tried to cancel the deal, only to be found not to have complied with the contractual requirements of cancelling the deal.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point from which members are coming. Perhaps yesterday we didn't ask SAE what was the reasoning behind cancelling the deal, and why a U-turn? A U-turn was explained yesterday that a U-turn was because SAA was found not to have complied with certain requirements within the contract. And therefore, they had to opt for this deal with added aircraft. I think that's what we were told yesterday, with a proviso, in fact, that said we were going to buy them in any case. Now, there is this
imbalance of the strategy.
Thank you, Stephen. I think you've helped me a lot there.
and that then justifies why we say there should be more aggressive management by DPE and not just oversight. You see, that's the whole point. Because you see, you exercising oversight, you know, it's like, you know, you are not very hands on, and that's not a mistake. The mandate must change as part of our recommendations. We must not just say DPE must just exercise oversight because we are doing what we as politicians are doing. I mean, well, why must you do what? What's our job then? Because we're doing parliamentary exercise at the risk of actually micromanaging. So we don't have to micromanage. It is your job to actually micromanage these SOEs. If you don't micromanage, and you cannot micromanage, if you don't micromanage, then of course this is going to happen, because it's unthinkable how the board of SAA could have just not foreseen what the chairperson is clearly exposing. And we're not blaming you. We are just saying you've done an excellent job to try and pull the rules together, but that should not have happened. But remember, your mandate that says back off, you're just doing oversight. You see, that mandate must change.
Okay. Chair, if I can perhaps respond to the last issue first, because I think it's quite critical. One must realize that under the current situation, the SAA would not be allowed to proceed with a transaction such as that Airbus deal. That transaction occurred at a time when the PFMA requirements were not in place, and that's a very important issue. Is they would require under any transaction now to purchase, and we're currently going through a process of assessing lease renewals in SAA, they would be required to come to the shareholder with the intention to proceed with such a transaction. And we would not have signed off a transaction with the conditions that we subsequently saw in the current transaction. The second issue about this issue of aircraft purchase in 2002 is there were three tranches of aircraft in that transaction, and they were cross-subsidized. So what management did at that time is they got a very good deal on the aircraft that they took ownership of at the beginning of the transaction, and they used the third tranche, which was the one that we renegotiated, as the basis of getting that good deal on the first tranche. And that meant that any change in those contractual conditions would have been at SAA's disfavor. The other thing about this transaction is that there's no mechanism. There was no mechanism written into the contract which allowed for SAA as a party to cancel the contract. And so they sent a letter to Airbus cancelling the contract, but that letter was of no legal value. And in a certain sense, I don't think it's even relevant at the time, because they knew full well that that letter had no standing. So we always knew that there was a problem, and the auditors picked it up, and in fact, the auditors' view was, unless you renegotiate this transaction, they will put it as a qualification in their accounts. And that pushed us to a point where government had to intervene. The value of government intervening is now it became an intergovernmental issue. So the process was initiated with Airbus, but also with France. And that allowed us some space to renegotiate. I don't believe SAA might have got to the same conditions of renegotiation if it had attempted to do that alone. So it was a very complex situation that we faced at that particular time. And I think that's where the conclusion that was face saving. I have a concern that the existing management said, look, we were lumbered with this deal. We can't afford it. We had to save face as a country. Therefore, government must bail us out. And for that reason, we continue to put the pressure on SAA to ensure that it can meet its obligations around the PDP payments for the aircraft as they come on stream.
Can I just, as a point of clarity, the CEO of SAA yesterday said they sent a letter, and then there was a mutual agreement that this letter had standing, or that they both knew they were at fault, and that's why they renegotiated, and that's why she called it face saving for both sides, if you can remember right. So what we are hearing now is totally different to what we were told yesterday.
No.
Yeah. She said both agreed that there was a fault on both sides.
Yeah, I think there's an understanding that we have. But the DG is putting the department side. Let's allow the DG to continue. Yeah.
Look, I'm fairly clear that having worked very closely with SAA management is that they would have no reason to give you a different story in this issue. We went through this difficult process collectively. So, you know, I don't believe that there's a difference of opinion in terms of how this thing was addressed. I think the issue is that we had to find some kind of amenable outcome, and we were both in that situation together. I don't know what happened yesterday, but I can't see that we would have a different view to current management. I mean, if that is the case, then we will go back and explore it with SAA. The risk assessment we will be dealing with on the 3rd of November, in any case, Anthony, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit further about that and the ability to perhaps have a look at Isiwuko in a more active mode.
In terms of like the DJ said, we will bring it up on the 3rd of November, and I think at that time we should be able to actually demonstrate because this system is actually web based, so we will be able to interact with the system at that presentation.
Okay, so we will prepare to provide you with that ability in the next meeting, the 3rd of November. In respect of the mandate of DPE and its control and responsibility over SAEs, I think we have to be quite clear here is that in the previous recommendations we did see some recommendation about how SAEs are managed, but we're in a fairly difficult position at the moment. The DPE did, under the previous administration, put forward a shift towards an agency type model. That was not supported at the time. It may or may not be a workable outcome. The reality that we face, though, is that there's a presidential review committee that has responsibility to look at this in detail. And it would be inappropriate for us to come here with a series of models that we think are appropriate because it undermines the role of that committee. We'd be very happy if you wanted to engage with them and through that process engage with us. But it would be unfair of us, I think, on them if we said, yes, this is the way we feel that SAE should be managed, etc. I think we're fairly clear that there needs to be some change, both in terms of where SAEs report, how they structure their reporting structure works, and perhaps what DPE is left with, if anything, or what kind of structure it has. I mean, it is clear that DPE's SAEs, the 9 that we had, were placed in DPE at a point in time in which there was a need to proceed with the process of privatization or part privatization of some of those activities, and that mandate has now changed. So if it is okay with the committee, if we could not provide some of those recommendations, in at least in this formal way, because I think it has the real danger of undermining the activities of the SAE panel. Ashley, I don't know if you want to add anything on that.
Not really, Andrew. I think, but just to highlight the fact that the SOE that reported to our department are all incorporated as companies, and as such, company law regulates the relationship between a shareholder, the board, and management of a company, and the certain responsibilities that are outlined by company law in the PFMA for those three different stakeholders within that structure. So as a company, there's a particular governance structure that's regulated by company law.
Is it an arm's length relationship, which is what we recommend it should cease to exist?
To a large extent, it is. In the sense that the board is supposed to be the custodian of the company, so the board would represent the company. That's why board members would then have fiduciary responsibility for the company and are actually held personally liable for breaching that fiduciary duty.
Right. Sorry, Chairperson, quickly, we've got this. Fiduciary duty, very good concept. You know, those board members who were serving on PBMR, to have sunk PBMR to a tune of 8 billion, if the law were to be applied, you can imagine they'd be taken to cleaners. They would go to heaven very quickly. Now, that's exactly why we're just worried about this aloofness. Because, I mean, it's unthinkable. I mean, you know, if I was a little green man from the moon and I heard the story of PBMR and even this one of SAA, but I mean, really, it's is like a story to our children. It's unthinkable how people with brains can make such mistakes. It's unthinkable. Unthinkable. That's exactly what I was saying. We can just have carry on again, because right now we are struggling to raise $20 billion for you for a very, very good cause, because money has been thrown into the dustbin, into the abyss, through PBMR and also through this many other deals, precisely because some people didn't actually do their work, and the guilt of the rich of Jews in respect of their fiduciary responsibilities.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mukwena. I think in the interest of time, I think let's allow the department to respond to the questions so that we may deal with another report that we still have to adopt the recommendations. Can we then allow the department, if you could, Andrew, move a bit faster.
I will do. Kuka was raised, the project around the port and the IDZ. The IDZ does not report to DPE. It is a responsibility of DTR. Many of the projects that were originally foreseen for that IDZ have fallen away. It does call into question, I think, not necessarily the viability, but it does call into question whether the whole concept will work fully over a period of time. Our response in respect of the ports is that we would encourage Transnet to work very hard with a partner that might be able to bring them transshipments into that container terminal as a way of maximizing the return on investment for that particular terminal, and we would focus on the terminal. We haven't been in discussions with the IDZ, but in a certain sense they have a separate responsibility. Theirs is just to look for investment partners, and when some investment partners may be found, we would be very willing to work with Transnet to ensure that they incorporate it as best as possible into the port infrastructure. I'm now on a question which was raised by Honourable Kraling around SOE and falling outside of DPE. I think I've responded to that, so I won't go back into the detail. The next set of issues that were raised were around ESCOM and the role of DOE. I think we are challenged by the fact that we are moving into a new policy framework for electricity specifically, which results in ESCOM's monopoly face being altered. For good, in most respects, but it does mean that we are requiring additional players, and we are also testing the market in ways which we've not tested before. And so in terms of electrification, some of that those issues do need to be seen in that context. The other thing to say about electrification that comes very clear from this analysis is that we captured all the low-hanging fruit quickly. And so electrification in areas where it was easy to electrify were obviously the first areas to be addressed. In deep rural areas, it's much more challenging and much more costly. And so that's makes it much more difficult. And so we probably need to revisit it. But that's probably a policy issue and not something that we can be intimately involved. Mm-hmm. The issue around heavy industry and electrification, yeah, I mean, that's fully understood. It's about our national economy. It's about the role of beneficiation and so on. It's a broader set of concepts that are not necessarily under the strict mandate of ESCOM, and that needs to be seen as such. Vuyo, I don't know if you wanted to add some of the issues around electrification and the funding requirements that were raised around this issue.
Thank you, Andrew. I think I wanted to respond to the question around the pricing agreements that were entered into with the smelters. We, as DPE and the National Treasury, are working together with ESCOM to try and renegotiate those contracts. So the process is underway, and we're not involved in the front line, obviously, but we are in the background trying to get ESCOM to try and get out of those as soon as possible. So I don't know if that gives you a little of comfort.
You want to make a follow-up there?
Well, no, I mean, my broader point is about trying to get some of these heavy industries to take some of the risk that you're asking the government to take on. I mean, what is the plan in place in terms of getting some kind of equity or risk-sharing agreements with some of these heavy industries who are ultimately going to benefit from this expansion program?
Look, the reality is such that you have a changed policy environment, and within that environment, to make these billion rand investments, is seen as risky, whether it's by the public sector or the private sector. So it's very challenging at this point in time to, you know, have vast tranches of equity that you transfer across to such a set of companies. I think our approach to this is to say, look, there's still a lot of space here for where you can involve some of the bigger players, either through risk share agreements contractually or through equity, etc. But what you don't want to do is slow down the build program, because then you put the country at risk. So our focus in dealing with Treasury is to say, look, let's get some equity injection and some guarantee support to ensure that Kusile, for one, is not stopped in its tracks, because if you don't deliver that project, you put the country at risk. Subsequent to making that call, you can begin to explore all sorts of structures to reduce government's exposure into this industry and for these power stations, etc. And so our next point of call is to do that. However, it's complex to negotiate those now. And if you spend a year negotiating those now, Kusile just gets pushed on and on and on, and we've already gone through the process of initiating that project. In order to get some minor benefit, you put the whole country at risk. So if you just reverse the thinking and you say, let's make Eskom provide it with a more solid financial structure in order to allow to proceed with the build program, we can then explore some of these things in more detail. And we are already doing so. It's exactly what. Okay. The issues around Honourable Member van Dalen raised the issues around the PFMA and the contractual issues around CEOs and so on. All CEOs are appointed under contract to the board of each of the entities. So it is a normal contract. It is for a limited period of time, and we encourage that there's a performance requirement for each of those CEOs. Alex Corr, and I'll come back to it because there's a number of questions that were asked a little bit later on around Alex Corr. Alex Corr is a very challenging situation because it's not in an entirely commercial initiative at the moment. There's a range of community and political issues that need to be considered in the Alex Corr environment. The other challenge is most of the diamonds have been mined, and the commercial reality of Alex Corr is not a hugely profitable company, as I think one of the members had indicated it might be. But we'll come back to that. If I can just deal with some of the issues that were raised in the order that they were raised. East London and agriculture and industry and so on, Transnet's investment program is based very much on supporting the core flows of product into the main terminals, the main ports. It does mean that at some points some of the more marginal areas are not given the attention that they deserve. And this is where I think we need some policy leadership from the Department of Transport particularly, because we may require some investment support for some of these sorts of areas. Port of East London is a very good example. Again, Airbus was raised. I think we've dealt with that. On budget issues and the rollout and the reduced budget, the rethink of the role of DPE, again, I've dealt with most of those issues. The kind of recommendations that we would make, I think we would hesitate to make any profound recommendations because of the risk we feel that would put us under. But the one thing that is quite clear to me is that I don't think that our consulting budget for me is an area of risk. In a certain sense, we deal with roughly 3% of the national GDP, and we spend very little money to do that. I think if we doubled or trebled our consulting budget and we got value in that process for the multi-billion dollar investments that we're dealing with, it would be money well spent. And so to focus on consulting expenditure, I don't see that is valuable to the department. The one area where I think from our sense and in terms of the set of recommendations is our ability to put greater pressure on the performance of SOEs, where I think the portfolio committee can play a really strong role. In the past, some SOE boards and management have got away with things that, and I think you recognize that, are probably inexcusable. And it is a challenging environment for us as DPE, as advisor to the shareholder, to always make sure that we get the correct outcomes from the board and management. So for me, that is a key focus area. We go to Alex Corr, and I think I'll ask Anthony to perhaps deal with some of the challenges of Alex Corr, given some of the background that we've heard and that I've mentioned already.
Well, just to start with the role of Alex Corr in terms of the strategic intent, it's basically to the exploitation of the diamond resources on a commercially viable basis. as well as the social upliftment of the areas in which they mine. But underlying this is this mandate is the fulfillment of all the obligations in terms of the deal of settlement with the Richard Swart community. You will know, honorable members will know that for a long time, yes, Alex Cole was profitable at some point, but at some point its operations were constrained, among other factors, were constrained by the land claim that was instituted by the research or community. So it really could not operate commercially. This settlement took about 10 years to reach some resolution. I think this started in 1998 and was on a deal of settlement was only signed in 2007. So that caused some level of constraint in which operating constraints, because for instance Alexco could not mine certain areas, you know, because those areas were subject to that particular claim. But in terms of some of its socio-economic obligations during that time, I think members will appreciate that when you look at Alexander Bay, it's located in a very remote area of the Richardsville. But the school that is that's the two schools, the primary school and the secondary school that serve the area, were built by Alex Cole. The hospital there was built and serviced by Alex Cole until very recently. When you look at the water supply in the area,
Where are the schools?
The schools are in Alexander Bay. There's a primary school and a secondary school, and it services the whole of the Richards Veld. The hospital similarly services the whole of the Richards Veld, including Port Nolo to the south. In terms of the water supply to the area, that is primarily Alex Go that has been supplying the water, including to Port Nolo towards the south. So yes, in terms of employment opportunities, at some point, yes. When mining activities were at the peak, there were a lot of employment opportunities. With the slowdown in the mining activities, this has come down. But Alex Cole remains a major employer in the area. But going back to the point of the underlying mandate, now with the conclusion of that settlement, that then put Alex Cole in more of a transition period towards the formation of the pooling and sharing joint venture with the community. The members will be aware that the land mining rights of Alex Cole are to be transferred to the Richardsville community, and Alex Cole will only remain with the marine mining rights.
The excellent question, the question that's asking Honorable Van Dalen and Honorable Esondoye, how did it come about that the CEO of Alesco was a contractor? How did it actually come about? And how do you compare that with all other, the CEOs of other SOEs? How did it actually, why was it allowed that the CEO should actually be the contractor? Where was DPE?
The CEO of Alex Cole is not a consultant. She is appointed as CEO and employed by the company. The function that has been outsourced is the finance function, and so that would be an acting CFO.
But she parachutes in and out of Alex Cole. And she was actually trying to be modest and say, here's a big house here, for the previous CEO, but around the big house, etc. She gave us the impression so modest, she wanted a small house, only to learn later on that she didn't actually live there. She's not in situ. And I mean, really. So, without cutting a spy, it's the same. But really, it's inconceivable that a diamond mining company like that can, you know. I mean, there's no transparency, there's no. It's difficult to believe when people say there's, you know, the gold reserves and diamond reserves are quite declining, because it means it's a subjective information which doesn't have any external verification.
Well, the CEO is not permanently resident in Alexander Bay. There is a small staff complement in Johannesburg. I think it's a two office situation that they have there. But at the mine, they do have a mine manager and all the operational people. So basically, the setup was made to ease the administration, considering that some of the operation the activities that were undertaken were in Johannesburg. But I understand that she spends a lot of time at the mine.
No.
Remember, I come in there with due respect, actually. This exercise actually is for Peru. Yes, it's for Peru. So that when we interject and ask questions, can we please focus on the exercise, and then I'll want that we move a bit faster, and let's allow the department to finish, and then from there.
I think the other question was in relation to the township development, and I think this particular aspect actually is part of the obligation in the Bureau of Settlements, and yes, it was funded by government in terms of a court order. But effectively, what this township upgrade was for is that, in terms of a deed of settlement, the Alexander Bay will be transferred to the community, and the registered local municipality will then take over the provision of services to the community for that purpose. Previously, AlexCo provided all the municipal activities in Alexander Bay, but Alexander Bay was not formally established in terms of the Planning Act as a township. But so, in order to give effect to that transfer transfer the municipal activities to the local municipalities, the services had to be upgraded, and this was funded by government in terms of a transfer. I think the total cost of that upgrade has come to 136 million. AlexCo is managing that upgrade, but it is funded by government.
Are we done to the question?
Chair, there's very few. It'll take me very short, very quick to just go through the last few issues. In respect of the 100 locos and whether there's old locomotive fleet and what happens to that, there is a plan within Transnet for the rehabilitation the increase in the fleet by 100 locomotives. They have what they regard as a cascade plan. What that means is that locomotives that were used in some parts of the business that are refurbished would be then cascaded to areas where the returns are slightly lower. So we get locomotives that are currently on the coal haul lines, when they are replaced, the locomotives that are currently there would be transferred to the GFP network after rehabilitation. Some may be scrapped in the end, and there is a program that we're working with together with DOT to take some of the locomotives that were available, diesel electric locomotives that were available on the smaller lines, and make them available as leased locomotives or as sold locomotives to new branch line operators. In respect of aircraft and lease or buy decision, my current understanding is that SAA is planning for a 50-50 split, which would be impacted on by their financial ability at the time. So they may decide to lease more if they find there are affordability constraints. But having said that, there are some airlines in the world that only lease, they don't buy. However, it's generally regarded that there should be some leased and some bought aircraft in your fleet because it gives you a certain degree of flexibility. The last issue that was raised by Honorable Santo is the issue of CEO and CFO appointment, and I'm going to ask Ursula if she can just deal with that quickly.
The appointment of CEOs and CFOs is generally regulated by the Articles of Association of the different SOEs. For most of the SOEs, the CEO is appointed by the board, and in some SOEs there are instances where the board would proceed with the entire recruitment process, and then once they've shortlisted the candidates, once they've interviewed and shortlisted candidates, then they would forward the names to the minister. But the Articles of Association of most of the SOE require that the board appoints the CEO.
I wanted to comment on this one. That's the model we would want to see, because the nasty practice that we've seen in the past or recent past is that CEOs tend to undermine boards.
Yes.
Because they say, you have not employed me. I was not employed by you, and therefore I'm not responsible, I'm not accountable to the board. It's a practice that we think should be done away with. The boards are there to, well, they can do that in consultation. But when you talk about the articles, that I don't know what that means. I'm sure it would inform our recommendation. And I wanted to ask you, in terms of the earlier response that you gave, the eloquence of that response would make us recommend that these boards should be the accounting points of the CEOs. That's the right practice. Otherwise, really, you would see boards being undermined by all the CEOs. Thanks.
Not much, Honorable Santo. We are happy that the President has appointed the review committee on the future of some of these SOEs, of which I think the committee maybe in future will have the opportunity of meeting some of the meeting the reviewer committee, so that they may appraise us on the future of some of these entities. Is there any other Honorable Khalid?
This is a follow-up on the issue around Eskom and the 20 billion that we've been asked to give to Eskom now. I'm still not completely satisfied with the response around the kind of risk-taking that the South African public has been forced to take on here, and the fact that we are not essentially going to be getting the rewards for that. And I think that in terms of the budgetary review, there needs to be some kind of a statement to say that at the very least, we need some kind of off-take agreements from these huge companies that are going to benefit from this. We need to know, because we've had this position before. We had it in the 80s and the early 90s, where we had stranded assets of Eskom, which had to be mothballed because the demand wasn't high enough. Now, how do we know we're not going to get into the situation again? How do we know that these companies are definitely going to build these smelters and are going to do that? And when I make this point, I mean, I read in the paper yesterday that Xstrata is looking at expanding their ferrochrome smelter, and that they are looking at investing in electricity generation. I don't know the details of that. I mean, is this the kind of model that we're looking at? But I really feel very uncomfortable now at giving a blank check once again to Eskom to say, go and build your power stations, and for us to take all the risk on board in a very troubling situation, and for us not to really get all the benefits of it. I mean, are we really going to get the benefits from all of this electricity generation, or is this going to be just a couple of industries which can, at the very last minute, actually pull out of these kind of expansion plans? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Khairin. I don't think the department will be able to respond to that. I think this is a policy matter. I will take that as an observation. I noticed the Honourable Bowman there.
Yes. No, Chairperson, I was just going to say that perhaps that is exactly what we can do, because that would be the beginning of the process, and I think that's the whole purpose of the BRRR. So, you know, and then I think things have got to get started somewhere or helped along, and I think this is the place where it can start. So I think we can do that as a committee.
That's my Honourable Bowman. Last one.
Yes. Small one, Chairperson, linked to the good input from the fellow MPGA. It's a little comment on the IPP, independent power producers. We haven't heard a word about it. I wonder if through Chairperson, if the acting DG can just say a few words on that, and then, because then that will then enrich this strategy of
Thank you, Honourable Mokwena. Yeah, we do constantly hear about the IPPs. Maybe if you could just respond on that one.
Look, I think, as we said before, the policy environment and the regulatory environment in electricity is changing dramatically, and it is foreseen that IPPs would come in. But our responsibility as the shareholder of the large state-owned entity is not to undermine that process. It's really just to allow that process to continue and to support it as necessary. We've also seen, and you raised the issue of large industrial concerns also wanting to enter power generation, the power generation industry, either for themselves or as a sort of for themselves but for export into the grid. I think we're into a different set of terrain, and part of the challenge with that is that we need to wait for that market to stabilize to a certain extent. But the recommendation that you have, which is that there should be greater pressure on a risk share type, I think we, particularly as officials sitting in the department, would completely support. We see the absolute need for exactly what you're saying. We're very mindful of this issue. And in fact, we would also not like it to fall off the table simply because we've supported SOE with all the necessary financial support for them to continue.
Thank you very much, Captain DG. We would like to thank you very much for your contribution to this exercise that we're doing. And we must say thank you once more. Honourable members, I think we can let the department to leave, because we still have to also look at the recommendations on our own. What is your feeling?
Yeah, you're right.
Just take 30 minutes or so.
Yeah, you're right, Chairperson.
From there.
Process is fine.
Thank you very much, department. Hope to see you again soon.
Okay, we also thank you. I think you asked some very difficult questions of us, and it required us to do some thinking and come back to you, which has actually informed our process. So it's actually useful to have followed what you requested from us last week, gone through the process, and without you realizing it, I think you also help us to think through some of the key issues. So thank you very much.
By the way, this is the first time, I mean, such an exercise is done in Parliament, so we're all learning actually in the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah.
Yes. Who has made fire here now? Viet Firche Magiso. Yeah. Yes.
What did he say? Who appoints the CEO?
In some cases, the minister appoints. And in other cases, the board appoints.
And we would say it should be the board.
It should be the board.
And they report to the board.
Exactly.
Because, appointment and removal of directors from the board, which includes the appointment of executive directors, CEO and CFO, were appointed ex officio. So maybe we should consider to say no, they must be appointed by the board.
By the board, yes.
I'm not going to play politics. So then they came running to Parliament when they had a problem. And that's when it overrode the board. And that, because then the minister would call a warning, and she would already have heard the story from the CEO, and then that was the problem. That was
government.
It shouldn't work.
The CEO must be appointed by the board.
Yeah, and he must answer to it.
And he must report to the board.
That's the way it should work.
But when you say that the board will say, yes, we will appoint the CEO, like we ask the position of the minister.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what they were saying.
They make a recommendation to the minister and the minister was approved. So that, you know, iemand kan wees wat is strategisch rigting kan gee op en denken van die regerende partijen.
It cannot work in that way. Yeah. They are going to cross the salt every time.
That's why the chairperson said we must get rid of the board. Because I mean, we are talking to the CEO already.
Yeah. What's the need of the board?
Which is getting sorted out, I think. I mean, the boards are getting the feel that they are charged now. Because they must make the responsibility to everybody.
But this question that this other woman was saying, that the boards have got their statutory status over which the department cannot
because they are held personally liable if they make the wrong choices. So you
no,
don't have interference and they keep the people liable if they make the wrong choice. Obviously, when you interfere in their decision, then, I mean, you must take responsibility for it. You can't have the board be responsible and then have to listen to somebody else. They must make their, on their own decision. With a political guidance from the minister.
Okay, honorable members,
okay.
Can we resume now?
Yeah.
Actually, we should not take long.
No,
this meeting. Actually, it should be, can we set a target? 30 minutes.
No.
Is it too long?
No.
Because basically what we're going to do here, we've got the recommendations before us. I think we've got the copy, say. And then what is going to happen is that the SAP is going to read us all the recommendations that we have on this report. And then members can add where they want to. Members can subtract where they want to. Members can comment where they want to. So right now I'll give Utisan the what to call to go through these recommendations and then we add where we want to add. Mm-hmm. Is that the process okay?
Yeah,
okay. On a moment.
Chair, I would agree with that, and then perhaps what I would also like to add is I think we've done all the debating and the questions. I think now we want to just stick to the recommendation, and if we all agree, that's fine. If there are points where we don't, then we leave it off or whatever, but not to enter into the whole discussion again.
Okay. Are you happy with that kind of arrangement?
Sure.
Okay, over to you, Dison.
Okay.
No, speak in the
mic.
I must speak
first to the committee observations. Some of them they might change because.
No. You've got a report in front of you. Take us through
the report.
Don't jump around to recommendations.
Okay. The first committee observation that we had there, the use of consultants for the year under review amounted to 51 million, and the explanation by the department is that this is as a result of the definition in the Public Service Act. The amount is, however, huge and has been growing each year. The department will need to reduce the use of consultant as cost-cutting measure. Concern over high number of vacancies at senior management services level, equaling to 27 vacant posts.
Sorry, then just itemize. That's the first one. That's the one. Two.
Okay. Yeah.
Where is this?
Number 7.
Page 12.
Yeah. Concern, this is number 2, concern over high number of vacancies at senior management services level, equaling to 27 vacant posts. Concern regarding the department's limited powers and strength to vigorously oversee the SOEs. And then emerging from this meeting we had today.
Concern of the mandate, just add the word mandate there.
Or the mandate. Uh, I said limited powers and strength. So must I check out limited powers and strength?
No. Just the concern with the mandate of.
Mandate, okay. Okay. And then the one that I picked up is the one that Honorable Grilling came out about, ESCOM's project. The ESCOM bill project that the consumers and those who are needy of electricity, they have to run the risk, take the risk and cost, while the energy intensive industries were spending more to benefit, as an observation.
Large commercial, Mr. Khaled, large commercial enterprises tend to, they consume too much, and then but they pay less.
They pay
and
less.
Then the burden is, I mean, the rest of the of the populace got to bear the brunt. But Lance is not here. He put it very eloquent. But
sure.
Must add,
the large users will take up the risk.
Yeah.
They're
large commercial enterprises, consumers. Must come to the party instead of shifting the entire burden of financing to the state.
And then the conclusion, like I said, that it's really based on the observations, whether the coverage is satisfied with the level of service delivery performance of the department, whether the department is...
Before conclusion.
Okay.
So it's a person. These guys want 20 billion. We must say... Treasury must, within its constraints, assist the DPE to fund the money. Because that's very key. It's a full crumb of the presentation. We can't just leave it like that.
I'm going to the recommendations now, which is number 9.
Just before you leave, observations.
Observation.
The first one is, it's been growing each year. The department is just on consultations, just so that it's decreased. So you cannot say it's been growing each year. Then you must check with the department, because they've just said to us it's decreasing. So that first bullet is not correct on the consultants.
Do you take it out?
Okay. Can we phrase maybe the first bullet? Are you saying that we need to rephrase the first bullet is wrong.
The whole of it.
The whole of it, that is about consultants, actually.
We're wasting time. The first bullet, as it stands, doesn't talk to what the department has just presented to the committee. I say marry the two.
I make a suggestion that we take out... The second line at the end, where after the full stop, we check out the amount is however huge and has been growing each year. We delete that part, yeah. And then, but the curriculum, we can leave the recommendation that the department will need to reduce the use of consultant as a cost-cutting measure. That part we can leave. And then we move to the second, can you move the observations now, Doc?
No, I think Mr. Grilling was away.
Okay,
if he's finished with his food, then he can make an input here.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, what I understood the department is saying about the 20 billion, that's now the fourth bullet, is that there's a balance between the smelters or the contributing to the broader economy, macro, and coming to be a part of the risk. So we need to find a way, and Mr. Geiling must assist here, how do we get that balance as an observation of the committee without saying DPE, Treasury, give 20 billion for the next 3 years. That will not be responsible. We need to find a balance, so Mr. Geiling can help us.
If I can just make a small suggestion, I think Mr. Hillen's point is very wonderful, but it's more long term. DP is saying now. So there have to be two bullets. We can't just have one. There must be the first one that says Treasury, do whatever you can to find the 20 billion. Right. Next point, however, when they're linked, is Mr. Hillen's wonderful point. So that because you see, we're dealing with the brr right now. Now, Mr. Hillen's point belongs there because you must knock on all those doors.
Yeah, but it won't happen within the next 3 months, 6 months.
No. I mean,
okay, that is through me. I'm the chair. In fact, can I say something now?
Yeah.
Can we maybe give Fredding the opportunity to express what he wants to express? Thank you.
Well, I mean, the point is that this isn't long-term. I mean, the fact is Kasili has been built to, and who's it been built for? It's been built to meet certain expansion plans of heavy industries. And what we need is that, and I think if we put this down as a point, is that we are concerned over the huge risk that the South African government is having to face over the new build program, given that the majority of the power will be used by a handful of energy-intensive industries. And we feel that some of that risk should be shared. Now, I don't know if we want to put it in terms of the recommendations then, as to how we do that, but I think the concern right now should be, if we are concerned at the huge risk that the South African government is being forced to take on for the new build program, given that it will mainly be used to fund the needs of heavy industry or of a small amount of heavy industry, and that there should be some risk sharing agreement.
I just want to clarify on the 20 billion that the TP talked about. Because to
me that seems to be very immediate as a need, because they were saying the 20 billion, they need it to strengthen their balance sheet so that they can go out to the market and borrow more. At the moment, their balance sheet is very weak and they've been underrated. So the 20 billion is mainly for them to strengthen their balance sheet so that they can borrow more on the market. But it's not a long-term thing the way I see it.
That's exactly the point I was making, Chairperson, that we need two bullets. The one that Mr. Hillary has met with so well, and this one. Yeah, they're two separate bullets. Although the spirit is in, but I mean, it's immediate, it's like next week, so to speak.
Because when I was under?
Mine is to say, risk share money, what is this? Risk share approach takes care of both. Once you say risk share approach, it means that the department is going to Treasury with that observation. On the 20 billion, there should be a risk sharing. Government should not go it alone. The department, ESCOM, should not foot the bill alone, but there should be that sharing.
Tuesday, when it's 27th, you see, all the members. We are together. But the reality that the minister on the 27th, you see, this thing has gone today. Next week, we're talking about 5 days. There's no way that we can hear before and talk some talk, have a CEO and say, help us with the 3 billion. That's why I say, let's not kill Hillary's approach. It's very good. But at the same time, mustn't undermine this one. Because once you start, putting them together, then, what are you saying about next week, Tuesday? Next week, on the 27th, it's going to be the BRRR day. That's the kind of point. So we cannot, after hearing the plea from ESCOM, from DPE, theorize and say, we cannot adopt a long-term approach. We cannot be an exclusive. Long-term approach is fine. This is there, but then just take care of it. Just emphasize this one. Because that's our job to do so. They're not killing each other.
I think we can find each other on this. I mean, I'm not necessarily saying the 20 billion shouldn't be given. I mean, I think but I think that you can put the two together. You can say we recognize the bad state of ESCOM's file, where you can put that in better language, but that the urgent need to fix ESCOM's balance sheet at this point in time and the 20 billion that is required to do that, but that we are concerned that what seems to be implicit in this funding model is putting a disproportionate share of risk on the state for the new build expansion program.
Agreed?
Agreed.
Okay. Next point. What about you?
However, we recognize that there's an urgent need for the 20 billion.
Let's not get into the classroom situation of syntax here. We'll take the whole afternoon. You've captured the sense, the secretary, and Eric.
Okay, Honorable, together with the Sun, they are going to make alterations after this. Meanwhile, let's move on to the next recommendation. With the researcher, Eric Oscar. So, read the next recommendation.
Okay.
And then, after that, Honorable Members, I'll expect that we...
Order, please. Yeah.
Can you carry on with the reading?
The recommendations, Honorable Koronov, I'm not used to talking usually, so I was just right. Based on the analysis of the department's budget for the year under review, the following recommendations are made. The department should mandate, number one, the department should mandate SOEs to embark on cost-cutting measures to eliminate ineffective programs in line with the Minister of Finance statement, which alludes to SOE's expenditure on high salaries, frills, travel, etc.
can I suggest the department has suggested this and we agreed to that we replace that paragraph with a performance of SOEs. It's much wider than the only this one you're reading now. That we say the performance of SOEs, and I don't have the wording, must be stepped up, it must be more effective oversight, and to make the correct outcomes coming from SOEs. That's what we discussed here. That is much broader, but it's inclusive of that bullet that you've put there. Because the recommendations, Disang, must address who must do what by when. So then you need to work those three questions in. It's the Department of Public Enterprises must increase the performance, oversight of the performance over SOEs, and it must be done immediately within the next financial year. Then Treasury was asking, was going to look at this recommendations. We'll not send it back to say, but it's incomplete. It's addressing the effectiveness, the readiness, and whatever other issues you said to us.
Honorable Koronov. Next recommendation.
Something to the line of the department should improve their oversight to ensure over SOEs to ensure performance of SOEs is improved.
Not oversight. We had parliamentarians do oversight. That word oversight is misplaced, a misnomer. We don't
rather say micromanage.
Not micromanage. But no, the mandate is already spoken about. They must manage.
Okay.
Just say manage. Forget about oversight. Replace oversight with manage. Rigorously manage.
Can I go to the second one?
The
department and SOEs should conduct risk management analysis to avoid risky commercial decisions, as exemplified by SAA's order of 15 aircraft over 10-year period for routes that turn out to be unprofitable.
Chairperson, I would delete that because it's in the first bullet. That is a performance. If we had the performance of SOEs really oversight and managed, it would not have happened. So that first bullet, we've just drafted, takes care of this one, because it's not only the 15 aircraft of SAA, there are other issues as well in other SOEs.
Is that good? Are you in agreement of that? Well, I remember.
Okay. The third one, completion of the funding model. Since no further funding will be provided, especially for those SOEs embarking on infrastructure problems.
What we should do here, replace that with an observation. You remember that observation where we talked about the risk share approach? Bring it in here and replace that one with a recommendation that there should be a recommendation for a more risk share approach by DPE and the SOEs within the next financial year or whatever.
Or perhaps to avoid that difficult route, just say no foreseeable. Add the word foreseeable funding. Just say no funding. Just say no foreseeable. Then it takes care of everything. Because you're not saying there will be no funding, but you may very well be forced to do that. Just say foreseeable. No foreseeable.
Agreed. Carry on.
Okay, the next one, the department must provide members of the committee with each of the SOE shareholder compacts so as to enable committee members to familiarize themselves with SOE's key performance indicators, especially their financial performance.
Can I suggest that we make a recommendation about the Presidential Review Committee, who's going to, amongst other things, look at all the SOEs and all the shareholder compacts, that we make a recommendation that we will await the report or recommendations of the Presidential Review Committee on SOEs, and that the committee must interact with the Presidential Review Committee regarding the recommendations before a certain time. Something like that.
Very good. Except I like the latter part. But you must also recognize what the committee expresses appreciation that there's a, and the presentation of the committee has been inaugurated and we're looking forward to interfacing with it before it, the finalization of its report.
Agreed. I recognize also Honorable Van Dalen.
Right.
I saw your head up.
Don't start trouble, man. Chairperson, don't start trouble.
Okay, next recommendation. The Department of Public Enterprises must provide clarity on the role of each of the SOEs to the country's industrial policy action plan.
I think, Chair, what we need to do here is we need to spell this out a little bit more and to say not only on the role of each of the SOEs, but also their infrastructure expansion plans and how they relate to the objectives of the Industrial Policy Action Plan. Because it's not just SOEs broadly. I mean, we need to know that if they're going to invest a certain amount in this infrastructure plan, what are the benefits to the country in terms of our industrial policy objectives? I think that needs to be rolled out very well.
Agreed?
Yes, agreed.
The next recommendation.
Can I add another one?
No, honorable members.
We can add more recommendations.
Shouldn't we consider this last discussion we had to make a recommendation about the appointment of CEOs and CFOs? That we make a recommendation that the appointment of CEOs of state-owned entities should be done by the boards of the particular entity.
And not the minister.
No, because we don't have to, and not by, how it should be done. If the committee agrees that we say boards must appoint the CEOs and the CEOs must report to the board. Just to get that governance, good governance approach correct. Whether we can get fired for this, I don't know. But it's
agreed, another member?
Yes.
Honorable Helen?
My recommendation then is, okay, let me just think about how to word this. I would say that a risk-sharing approach be adopted to Eskom's new build program, whereby the heavy industrial, or let's say, whereby the energy-intensive industries who will benefit from this program will share some of the risk for its funding. And then I can put down the specifics as to how that might happen. Do you want to keep it broad? Okay. And well, I think one point that does need to be made, though, is that at the very least, we should be securing takeoff agreements with the heavy industrial users so that there is a guaranteed market for the energy expansion that we're putting in place. So I think that should be a specific recommendation.
Couldn't you say then the recommendation as you said it first, which might include what do you guys just
which could include either equity share or definitely a takeoff agreement. We need to know that we've got a firm market for this before we vote. I mean, that's fine.
Yeah.
Do you agree to that one? I don't remember.
In keeping with the triple P, because what Clary is saying is absolutely correct. It's in keeping with the triple P.
Yeah.
Private partnership and so on. Triple P.
Okay. Have we exhausted all recommendations, honorable members?
That is one. Then someone has also got the recommendation.
No. I'm in agreement with all your recommendations.
How many are they on and off? Because the number of
observations,
and then
recommendations one, two.
Ronald. Chairperson, can I just ask the secretary and the researcher, when we go through the report, we've just heard that the mandate of the department has changed in the new parliament. And when I go through the report here, your mandates that you talk in the report is dated back in your footnotes to 2006-2007. I would suggest, just on the body of report, ask the researcher and the secretary, when they go through the report, just make sure that the mission, if they talk about the mission of the department, it's a mission now since 2007, that we don't quote the mission here, that's from a previous parliament. Secondly, when we talk about oversight responsibilities of SOEs, that you, if you quote it, put a footnote, say, I got it's from this document. Thirdly, if we took strategic priorities and measurable objectives, when I read that paragraph 2 of the body, it doesn't talk to the heading. You say priorities and measurable objectives, but you address other issues apart from that. I think it needs to be corrected. Paragraph 3, now I've got on two documents now. The analysis, have you put them the table in? You see paragraph 3, analysis of strategic and operational plans table. There's no table here. Okay, so it must be corrected. You talk there, paragraph 3, measurable outputs, but in the previous paragraph you put, you talk about paragraph 2, about measurable objectives. So it must be corrected. That table at the bottom of that page, there's no heading of that table. It just stands alone. Nobody on this side of the world knows what it is about. So you need to give a heading from the, whatever it may be. Economic classification, is it for sport and recreation? Or is it DPE or whatever? And then the analysis of the annual report and financial statements. That whole paragraph, you need to make sure that the annual report that we submitted as part of this committee, that part must be in here. Just make sure. The next page, a heading. There's no heading of a table. There's no heading of which department, nothing. Section 32, that's fine. And the same, the rest of the document, the administration, the various programs that you have, I think you need to just clean it up technically, because you use footnotes, but in the whole of the document, I don't see footnotes unless it's at the end. No, it's also not at the end. And you use certain abbreviations that's not explained. I think it needs to be cleaned up technically.
Thank you, Honourable Colonel. Are you done? Honourable Bobman?
Yes, and in addition to that, I think I have mentioned this before. I think our oversight report does need to refer to the time that we went. When did we go? Was it May 2009? Was it April 2010? It hasn't got to be the detail, but we need to know just, you know, when those oversight visits were.
Thank you, Honourable Bowman. Was there any format for this? For the information? Oh, okay. Do you want to?
Members, can I just also take you to one? There's one observation that speaks about the vacancy rates. Probably we can make a recommendation regarding as to when does the committee feel that the vacancy at senior management level be filled.
Just look up the another small one. I don't think we can miss that. It's an observation about the turnover rate, the high turnover rate, staff turnover rate.
We're going to just add it in the vacancy rate. But he wants to know what recommendation are we making. We made the observation, but there's no recommendation on it.
Yeah.
So So we can't make an observation and not make a recommendation.
So in other words, the number of observations should be equal to the number of recommendations.
No, it's just that if you make an observation, you should have a recommendation to address it. Otherwise, you take out the observation.
Okay.
We filled in, that's all. Yeah.
Yeah, it's straight. Vacancies to be filled. Agreed.
I think that's too low.
Now, can't you say as soon as possible, but you give it time?
We could say ASAP. As soon as possible. Okay. Okay. I hope we have done justice to the recommendations, not unless there is some more. Is there any mover to the recommendations, honorable members? Is there any mover to the adoption of this recommendation?
Are we not?
How many? Seven, yeah. Any seconder? Okay. Honourable members, I think this meeting stands a chance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think you. I will call members.